This week on The Best of Flashpoints, our Iraq correspondent Ahmed Habib takes a look back at the last year of U.S. occupation and further corporate privatization of his country. Also, voices from delegates of the Gaza Freedom March, Ali Abanima, Barbara Lubin, Hedy Epstein, and Dr. Mona Al-Fadr report from Cairo, Egypt. Joe Seiko talks about his new book, Footnotes in Gaza, and Andres Tomas Canteras reports from inside the Brazilian embassy in Tegucigalpa as the coup in Honduras continues to launch lethal attacks against the people in the streets. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We now focus on the deteriorating situation in occupied Iraq. Al Jazeera is reporting that at least 23 people have been killed and 57 injured in twin suicide bombings in the western U.S.-occupied Iraqi city of Ramadi. As 2009 winds down to a close and as the U.S. occupation of Iraq rolls ahead into another insufferable year, we thought we'd take a look at the past 12 months of occupation and get a sense of what the next year will look like for the Iraqi people under U.S. military occupation and colonization of their country. Joining us once again is our special correspondent, Ahmed Habib. Ahmed is an Iraqi journalist and spoken word artist. He's a freelance reporter for Al Jazeera and Electronic Intifada and joins us from Doha. Ahmed, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you for having me again, Nora, and I'm always happy to be on such an exciting and really important media outlet such as KPFA, and what a great show you have. And I hope next year is another year of Flashpoints and where we can really have these important discussions on the air.
Thank you. So do we. Well, it's good to have you back with us on the program. Let's begin with talking about the last 12 months, the seventh year of this egregious and lethal occupation of your country, and your reaction to today's bombings in Ramadi, you know, this ongoing ubiquity of violence right now in Iraq.
As people around the world get together with loved ones to celebrate the dawn of a new year, a new decade, Iraqis will huddle around each other to gather strength to face another year under American occupation. The bombing, the violence that we witnessed today, of course, is another chapter in the destruction of Iraq. For the last 7 years, we've seen over 1 million people die. 5 million people have become refugees in a record time. We see that the infrastructure of the country has not only not been rebuilt, but in fact has been destroyed. The systematic theft of Iraq by American military contractors, by a corrupt government, has really left the Iraqi people in a situation where survival is their utmost priority. And of course, you know, in contrast to that, we see an Iraqi government that seems adamant at trying to project itself as a democratic institution. We just now, of course, in the last few months of the year, the Iraqi parliament was able to get itself together and pass an election law. And really, these elections, what they're going to translate in terms of reality and people's lives in Iraq is that there's going to be an increase in the violence. The way that politics under sort of unfold itself in Iraq is perhaps not what our listeners in the United States are used to, you know, in terms of expensive television commercials or boring debates. But in Iraq, unfortunately, these sort of differences are dealt with through violence, bombings, car bombings. And, you know, in the last few months of the year, we saw horrific bombings that ripped through the heart of Baghdad. And I think that that's a real sign that the election campaign in Iraq is underway. And the Iraqi parliament, I mean, last week there was a session held in the Iraqi parliament that was going to discuss the budget for Iraq in 2010. And a whopping number of 12 members of parliament showed up. So I think it's really indicative of how serious the Iraqi government is at governing Iraq. Again, the most important indicators of success in Iraq, unfortunately, are ones that perhaps aren't found only in the number of people killed by acts of violence, but are also buried beneath the chronic failure of the Iraqi government to provide for its people, in the city of Baghdad, the capital city of Iraq, a city of over 5 million people. There is still a shortage of electricity. Some areas in the city get only up to 5 or 6 hours a day of electrical power. There is a complete lack of healthcare in a country that, of course, has already been destroyed and shattered by over a decade of genocidal sanctions that killed over 1 million people. There is a lack of basic services in areas of education and other social services. And, of course, we see that Iraqi youth wander the streets of Baghdad searching for breadcrumbs, searching for dignity and employment. And those are the real indicators that we should be looking at, not election dates, not how many members of parliament are running for which party. That is the kind of language and discourse that the Iraqi government, in conjunction with their American occupiers, are very busy trying to push. But the people of Iraq are very cognizant of what the reality on the ground is. It's corruption, it's killing, it's chaos. And although people that have been reporting outside of Baghdad have been trying to portray an image of relative calm and improvement in the situation with security, and that might be the case compared to horrifying conditions that Iraqis lived in at the peak of the so-called sectarian violence in 2007, but that is not a reason, or that is not an accurate description that should lead us into a state of complacency where we think things in Iraq are heading in the right direction. The constitution, which is sectarian in its most fundamental ethos, is still at the heart of the decisions that are being made by the Iraqi government and the way in which political power is being divided. We see that the systematic selling off of Iraqi natural resources in the absence of a legal mechanism to measure the transparency of such decisions is now really being highlighted with the dozens of oil contracts that have either been signed or about to be signed with foreign companies. And I think that it's important for people in the West, particularly to our listeners in the United States, to hold their governments accountable for the war profiteering and the destruction of Iraqi society that we're seeing. And of course, at the same time, when looking at Iraq, is not to look at it in a vacuum, but to really look at it within the context of Israeli apartheid, within the context of the occupation of Afghanistan, within the context of the war mongering, the beating of the war drums that we're seeing with countries like Iran, with countries like Yemen. And I think it's important to look at it as another tragic episode in the so-called war on terror, which is really a war of terror itself.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our coverage from Cairo and Egypt, where hundreds, if not thousands, have gathered from the United States and around the world to commemorate the savage bombing of the Gaza Strip 1 year ago today by Israel, with full U.S. support, both politically and with weaponry. Barbara Lubin of the Middle East Children's Alliance is there trying to get in for this Gaza Freedom March, but the struggle is on. And Barbara, I understand you went to try and see some diplomats, but you ended up in a pen for 4 hours. Could you tell us about that?
Yes, around 40 of us decided that since we're from the U.S. that we should go see our embassy and try and get a meeting with the ambassador or someone high up at the embassy. And we walked over to the U.S. embassy and tried to talk to the Egyptians to see about getting in. And right as we started walking towards the embassy and got onto the grounds of the embassy, the Egyptians surrounded, soldiers, about 100 of them surrounded us, and they gated us in and kept us in this gated pen for 4 hours. And Medea Benjamin from Code Pink managed, and somebody else managed to get out and finally did get up to speak to somebody, not the ambassador, but somebody representing the government, who said that they were in no position to help anybody get into Gaza, that they feel it's not safe and that they are not going to do anything to help us, and that their role is only to see that we are safe.
So they kept
safe and imprisoned for 4 hours.
Right. So they kept you safe, surrounded in a pen for 4 hours. Tell us about that moment, though, became a discussion moment and an organizing moment. Who was in the pen with you, and what was that dialogue like?
Well, Bill Ayres and Bernadine Dorn were in there, Father Louis Vitale, just a lot of really wonderful people, young and old. And, you know, we would tell stories, we would talk about organizing, and, you know, us older folks would be having one discussion, and then we'd try and talk to the young people. And it was a really kind of interesting afternoon. And it was great. You know, there was a difference in the organizing, and, you know, I sort of was rolling my eyes when people started singing, you know, "We Shall Overcome" and all the rest of it. You know how I am about that. And but, you know, there were different points of view. I had a long little conversation with Father Louis and David Hartsock and his wife, both from the Bay Area, about nonviolence. You know, I said that I felt, of course, nonviolence was always the preferred way to struggle, but that in some cases, armed struggle is the way to also struggle, and that many, many movements using both methods, I was primarily talking about the South Africans, had won their struggle both through nonviolence and armed struggle, and that it wasn't for us. We can say that we believe in nonviolence. We will practice nonviolence as U.S. citizens, but it's not for us to tell others in other parts of the world how to struggle for justice.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we continue our coverage of Gaza 1 year after the bombing. We are joined by Ali Abunima of the electronicintifada.net. He is also in Cairo trying to get in as a part of this Gaza Freedom March. He had attempted to meet with the U.S. embassy officials today. There's breaking news. And also, Ali Abunima, while all this is happening, Netanyahu, the Israeli prime minister, is in Egypt for some kind of meetings around peace talks and prisoner swaps. Maybe we should start there.
Yeah, it's pretty outrageous that there are more than 1,300 people in Cairo. Actually, I would say over 1,500, because there's people from Spain and Italy and France and dozens of countries. Their demand is simply to be able to go across to join hands with people in Gaza for this march. And we're not allowed to, but Netanyahu is able to travel freely to Egypt to meet with the Egyptian president, and it sort of adds insult to injury that Netanyahu should be received here while people in Gaza are commemorating and mourning their loved ones who were killed in the massacre a year ago and still under siege and have not been able to rebuild their lives or begin to heal.
And also, while, as you say, over 1,500 other people have come to try and recognize that and give some support and aid to the suffering, and they too are being restrained, penned up, surrounded by security forces. You yourself attempted to get into the U.S. Embassy today. I imagine that was somewhat frustrating. What was going on there?
It was incredible, Dennis. Over a couple of days, groups, people have gone to the U.S. Embassy to try to talk with them. I went yesterday afternoon with several people to present a letter, and we were not received. We were told to come back this morning, and we did that. And we were again turned away. Eventually, there were about 40 American citizens who came to their embassy to ask to meet with the ambassador, to ask for the United States government, to ask that we be allowed to proceed to Gaza and to talk to the United States government about its support for the siege. We were actually detained by Egyptian security forces who arrived on the scene in en masse very quickly in riot gear. And we had this extraordinary standoff for about 4 hours where you had one group of U.S. citizens of 31 people who were completely surrounded by riot police and barricades and not allowed to leave. They were actually detained. And another group of 7 people about 50 yards or so away who are in the same situation. And I was calling it the West Bank and Gaza Strip. We demanded that the embassy actually take its responsibilities to these U.S. citizens who are being harassed and roughed up, although I should stress that by Egyptian standards, we were treated very, very gently in the sense that if we were Egyptian citizens attempting to hold a demonstration, I think we would have received much more harsh treatment. But having said that, we were detained. Eventually, 3 of us were allowed to go into the embassy, myself, Medea Benjamin, and Kit Kettridge, and we had a discussion for more than an hour with a political officer, and what I can tell you from that meeting is that really the bottom line is that the United States government does support the siege of Gaza and was not willing to, the embassy was not willing to do or say anything to facilitate us from reaching Gaza in an act of nonviolent solidarity and support for Palestinian civil society. And we made the point that this is exactly the sort of action that President Barack Obama called for in his speech in Cairo in June, and that part of the motivation of the many hundreds of U.S. citizens who'd come to Cairo with the hope of going to Gaza was inspiration by that idea. And people have come at their own expense, retired people, professional people, students, and found themselves being met by this extraordinary response at the U.S. Embassy. One thing that I think is very important is that the political officer we met with at the embassy, Mr. Greg LaGreffo, did confirm that the United States Army Corps of Engineers is providing technical assistance to Egypt to build this wall, this so-called underground wall that is intended to cut off the tunnels, which are the last lifeline of people under siege in Gaza. And that is outrageous that the United States Army Corps of Engineers is doing that, given that they have still not rebuilt New Orleans, and of course the outrageous violation of human rights and international law that the siege wall, this tightening of the siege, represents. So that was the scene at the U.S. Embassy, and after a really tense standoff, eventually, we were allowed to leave, and we were allowed to enter the embassy in small groups to speak to a consular officer. Really, what we learned today is that the U.S. government, or was reconfirmed, is the U.S. government fully supports this siege of Gaza.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our discussion of the commemoration of the Gaza Strip a year after savage bombing by the United States and Israel, which left some 1,400 people or more dead, hundreds of children murdered, churches, mosques, UN compounds, schools leveled, devastated, has been called a war crime or an alleged war crime by several major human rights organizations. Joining us is Dr. Mona Alfar. She is a medical doctor who lives in the Gaza Strip and works there and also works with the Middle East Children's Alliance. Dr. Mona Alfar, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Yeah, hello, and thank you very much for taking the interest in Gaza and what's going on in Gaza, because gather. We feel that we are alone and we are abandoned by the world. That's why we are very pleased. People are very pleased in Gaza that Gaza Freedom March and the Viva Palestina are trying to enter Gaza for the memory of the first anniversary of the... I don't call it a war, I call it the assault against Gaza. Yeah, and the situation is really bad in Gaza. If I want to talk about the health situation, we're still struggling hard to get the medication we need for our patients and struggling hard to take care of the medical equipment. Many highly sophisticated medical equipment that is very needed for the patients have been destroyed, not destroyed actually, ruined because we don't have repair parts or because of the interrupted electrical power, still the same. The problem of electricity that we don't get on a regular basis. Besides that, the closure of the borders does not allow us to get the repair parts for our highly sophisticated machines or the X-ray films or high-needed medications for patients, daily needs for patients. Besides that, the big problem is referral of our patients. You know, the health facilities in Gaza have been historically not fully functioning. And now add to that the closure of the borders make it very, very difficult for patients who need referral abroad. For example, cancer patients, and there are hundreds of cancer patients, including infants and children, need to be referred for treatment either in the West Bank, Israel, or Egypt. The closure of the borders make it extremely difficult, extremely impossible for patients to get the right treatment at the right time.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's Dr. Mona Al-Farda. She's talking to us from Cairo. They're trying to get back into Egypt. She works and lives in the Gaza Strip. Dr. Mona, let me ask you about this specific thing regarding the destruction of hospitals and medical facilities. We heard of many bombings during the over 3 weeks of sky, air, land, sea attacks. What about those actual facilities? Have they been rebuilt?
No, actually, nothing has been rebuilt because constructing material did not enter Gaza. So people who lost, for example, hospital has not been deconstructed because we don't have cement. And it is not only hospitals. It is people who are, people whom their homes have been destroyed, which is 20,000 people, 20,000 families has lost their homes, either the complete loss or partial loss. But 25,000 people, families, lost their homes, and they are still... They are still, some of them are in tents and some have to other places, but they are considered as homeless people because they could not reach their homes. And this is not the only problem. One step lead you to another step. Poverty is very intense in Gaza because people are unemployed. What happened in the 3 weeks against Gaza left people... really traumatized community. That's why we, as the Middle East Children's Alliance, trying to do our share by going on with this psychological support program for children, support the children and the mothers while they are under such circumstances. We are trying, but this is not enough. We need the whole world, everybody to take its share, because what is happening in Gaza, it is crime against the humanity. It is injustice and crime against the humanity. I'm not talking about Hamas. I'm not talking politics now. I'm talking about the humanitarian crisis that is going on day by day, and it is exaggerated as time goes by without any solution.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we stay in Cairo, Egypt, where we are continuing to report on those who are trying to be a part of a Gaza Freedom March into the Gaza Strip 1 year after the horrifying, deadly bombing of the Gaza Strip, killing so many people. We continue that discussion now with Hedy Epstein. She is on a hunger strike. She makes sure to know the difference between strike and fast, a political action to, at least in part, put pressure on the Egyptians, the U.S., and the Israelis to open up those gates and let the marchers go into the Gaza Strip. You started on this hunger strike yesterday. How are you feeling today?
I'm feeling fine. I'm drinking water, and I'm drinking orange juice. And orange juice has magnificent powers. Every time that I drink a glass of orange juice or a bottle of orange juice, I get an infusion of energy.
Well, I'm glad.
Felt hungry even once.
Or you maybe part of it is being filled by the commitment and the work.
This is my first hunger strike, and so I don't know. I can't compare it to anything. But maybe all of that plays into it. You know, if you are committed to do something, you are committed and you do it, and everything else sort of becomes a sidebar.
We're speaking with Hedy Epstein. She is an 85-year-old Jewish Holocaust survivor who, as we said, is trying to get into the Gaza Strip. Why don't you tell us about your day today? Are you hopeful? We understand there's a breaking story that maybe 100 people might be allowed to go into the Gaza Strip. What was your day like today, and are you hoping to get in?
The day today was wonderful. We had a wonderful demonstration in front of the Journalists Association or whatever it's called. There were, I don't know how many people were there, maybe all of us, or if not all 1,400 of us, very close to it. And I really, there was so much energy there and so much positive feelings about, you know, we're going to make it, we're going to get in. And it was just a wonderful experience. And I've had interviews from, I think, probably, if not all 42 countries, but from many, many, many countries that interviewed me throughout the day today and yesterday, but not a single American journalist was there.
Not a single American journalist? That's what you're saying?
Right. The only American contact has been with you.
Well, we're honored to have you with us. I can't help but thinking about the symbolism and the poignancy of there are about 1,400 of you there, and that's about the amount of Palestinians who were killed, stuck,
right,
or left in the Gaza Strip under a massive carpet bombing. I'm wondering if that figure occurs to you. And
But you are absolutely right.
It's almost like one person standing for every Palestinian.
Yeah. Wow. That's amazing. I hadn't thought of that.
Well, tell us about, remind people why you've decided to take this extra step at 85 years old, which is to go on this hunger strike. Tell us what's the core.
It has nothing to do with my youth of 85 years. It has to do with my commitment and my concern and my love for the Palestinian people, especially the Gazan people, after what they have gone through in the last year since this massacre started in December of last year. It's to be in solidarity with them. It's to bring them a message from people back home who were saying they are sending them greetings and their love and their concern. It is so that if I do get there, is to, when I come back, I can tell the American people, I can tell my Congress people, and maybe even Obama someday, that what I have seen and experienced, they can no longer say, well, you know, that's the media, they exaggerate, or it couldn't have been quite that bad. I can say, you know, I have seen it with my own eyes. I have talked to people, and I've heard their stories. It's kind of, it'll be more difficult to discount it or to discredit it when I can say, I have been there, I've seen it.
If you could have a minute with the president right now, let's just say he's listening, what would you want to tell him about your commitment to this?
Get in whatever his personal plane is. Get in there and come over here quickly and come with us to Gaza. I think Mr. Mubarak would not refuse him.
All right. Hedy Epstein on the second day of a hunger strike, trying to call attention to the great suffering that continues for the Gaza, the people of the Gaza Strip and Palestine. And there she is in Cairo with 1,400 other people from around the world trying to have those gates open up so this Gaza Freedom March can continue. We admire your courage, and we're honored to be the only American press that you're talking to. And we say hello to you and all those who have joined you on this strike in St. Louis and from other countries around the world.
Thank you very much.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. The Gaza Strip is built upon the fragments of innumerable killings and invasions, massacres, and political tug-of-wars since 1948. Nearly every day, there are new attacks, new headlines that reveal another layer of suffering and despair wrought upon the Palestinian populace in Gaza. But award-winning reporter, cartoonist Joe Sacco, on a return trip to Gaza, digs through the margins and focuses on massacres that happened within a short period of time in 1956, on a quest to unravel the threads of history, capturing in striking and devastating detail what he calls, quote, the footnotes to a forgotten sideshow of a forgotten war. Recognizing the tumbling and multi-layered momentum of history in Gaza in particular, Sacco continues, quote, history has its hands full. It can't help producing pages by the hour, by the minute. History chokes on fresh episodes and swallows whatever old ones it can. Joining us to talk about his return to Gaza and his new book, Footnotes in Gaza, is Joe Sacco. Sacco is the author of several books, including the graphic nonfiction works such as Palestine, which received the American Book Award, and Safe Area Garajdi, about the war in eastern Bosnia in the 1990s. That book won the Eisner Award and was named a New York Times Notable Book and Time Magazine's Best Comic Book of 2000. Sacco's books have been translated into 14 languages, and his comics have appeared in Details, the New York Times Magazine, Time, Harper's, and The Guardian. He joins us from his home in Portland, Oregon. Joe Sacco, it's a total thrill to have you with us today on Flashpoints.
Well, thank you very much.
And you're going to be here in the Flashpoint studio in a couple of weeks when you come through the Bay Area on your book tour. So this is part one, you could say, of a two-part interview with you.
Okay.
You spent the better part of the last decade researching, writing, and crafting this tremendously intimate portrait of the history of Gaza through this microcosm lens of two massacres in November of 1956, one in Khan Yunus and the other in Rafah, both within an eight-day period when hundreds of Palestinians were slaughtered by the Israeli military. And like every single massacre, every ethnic cleansing operation, every displacement, every bombing, house demolition, these killings continue to reverberate and echo loudly decades and decades after they've happened, you know, as though they've happened yesterday. Can you talk about why you chose to focus on these two massacres during this period 53 years ago, what the impact of them had and still has on the imprisoned and battered population of the Gaza Strip?
Well, to make a long story short, I had read something about a UN document that mentioned both massacres, and I found the document and read about what happened in Khan Yunus, where about 275 Palestinians were killed, and then what happened in Rafah, where about 111 Palestinians were killed in 1956. And, I mean, the first question in my mind was, how come I really didn't know anything about this? The UN document gives it gives an Israeli side to the story, which is basically there was resistance, and a Palestinian side basically saying there was no resistance. And I thought, well, there must be people still alive that remember this, so why not try to find them and talk to them and get their story? And that was the impetus to go there, and to find that out. I mean, I traveled there earlier with Chris Hedges, the journalist, and we had discovered something about this. And unfortunately, what he reported was cut from his magazine article. So I thought, you know, that sort of thing galls me. I mean, the idea that history is left out when we're talking about what's going on now. And I think it's important to look at the past to get sort of a context of what's going on when we watch the news today.
And you point out in your book that the prime minister at the time, Golda Meir, basically brushed off, you know, the Palestinian accounts, the eyewitness accounts, the UN reports that said that, you know, nearly 400 Palestinians had been killed in an 8-day period. You know, similar to tactics that are taken now by Israeli officials and American officials, for that matter. As you dug through this story, what kind of stood out most for you in terms of the, you know, the similarities and the differences in a 53-year difference?
Well, I mean, these things are just going on and on. I mean, of course, people I spoke to who remembered 56, also a lot of them remembered what happened in 48. They were children at the time, but they remember what the Palestinians called the catastrophe when they were displaced from their homes. And what was interesting is when you're talking to people, they would often get mixed up. Something from 67 would creep into their recollections of 56. And I guess this sort of impressed me because I realized that they've never really had a time to sort of sort things out themselves because, as someone told me when I was there, events are continuous. It's almost as if one layer is lying on another layer and they're sort of melding together in a way. So that's the thing that impressed me the most is this feeling that it's a continuum that they've never really digested what's happened to them. And of course, you know, we've seen with this the recent attack about a year ago on Gaza, you know, another generation has something to contemplate, and maybe in another few years there'll be something else to contemplate. It seems like history is never really arrested for them so that they can digest it and, I won't say let it go, but sort of incorporate it into what they are and move on. It's almost as if there's like one pummeling after another.
That's the voice of Joe Sacco. We're talking about his new book, Footnotes in Gaza. This is essentially the story of finding a story, collecting scraps of people's recollections of their parts in the story, gluing back the fragments of what was lost to history. And you have a short section in the book near the end in which you and your friends are sitting there kind of taking in the absurdity of your treasure hunt of sorts. And you talk about what you define as the, quote, frailty of human memory. Your friend and your fixer, Abid, laughs about not being able to remember what he had for breakfast the previous morning. And you point out that you would remember being beaten the previous morning. You would remember, you know, your home being demolished, for example. And so there's stages, you know, levels of what sticks to one's memory. And can you talk about both the frailty of human memory and the sharpness of human memory, you know, what you discovered through researching this book in Gaza? And some of the people you interviewed remembered incredibly significant and minute details from 50 years earlier. You know, you mentioned that sometimes the time, the years would get mixed up, massacres would kind of bleed into each other. But for the most part, some of these details were just extraordinary. Talk about what you learned in that process.
Well, I mean, you do learn about the frailty of memory, and you learn that some people manage to retain more than others, of course. I think that's why the story about Rafah was intriguing to me. Because it's in Rafah, the Israeli army was screening for Palestinian soldiers and guerrillas, and they made people run to the school and then wait in the school while they tried to select people who they thought were combatants. Now, this is a story I'm trying to reconstruct that took place 50 years ago. So obviously, we're talking about a day-long event. And obviously there are moments, there are whole periods where they're waiting in the school where a number of things happened that people had a hard time remembering or would remember in different orders from others. And that makes sense to me because when you're spending, let's say, 6 to 8 hours in a school, and you know, an officer showed up and mentioned something, that the town notables were made to stand up, these sorts of things, you're going to get things like that mixed up. But what people do remember are very sharp incidents, often very sharp incidents. Like, I could count on almost every man to remember being beaten at the gate as they entered the school. I was told over and over again that Israeli soldiers were at the gate with long sticks, beating people on the head and the back as they jumped over a ditch and barbed wire to get into the school. That's the sort of thing that would stand out in people's mind. And I don't shy away from showing the contradictions in stories, like one story to another. There are discrepancies. But I think the overall arc of almost everyone's story is the same. Everyone mentions being herded down the street, being beaten, being fired upon, and then especially being beaten at the gate. Everyone remembers those sorts of things. And everyone has, the overall arc of everyone's story is the same, but clearly you're gonna get different recollections about some of the specifics in a case like that.
When you went looking for these stories and searching out the characters who played roles in these stories, who were beaten at the school, who had relatives lined up against walls in Khan Yunis and shot by the Israeli soldiers, what was it like for the people you interviewed to go back there 50 years earlier in their mind? As a journalist, I know that it's sometimes very difficult to navigate through a very emotional and very troubling story that you're trying to squeeze out of somebody. What was that like for you?
Well, I always think it depends on the individual you're speaking to. Some, they can almost pull themselves out of the story and tell it as if they were watching someone else 50 years ago who was going through that sort of thing. For example, there's a guy who talks about in Rafa being shot on the way to the school with a number of other people, and he sort of he almost laughs about it. Perhaps it's his way of distancing himself from the memories. Other people, when they're telling these sorts of stories, I mean, they're breaking down. They're crying sometimes. It's clearly a really emotional thing to have to bring up. But like I say, I mean, it really depends on the individuals. And often often what I encountered were people who, they would have this look on their face when I mentioned 56 and what happened, and if they could tell the story, and sometimes they'd break down, but usually they were able to sort of gather themselves together and then just tell the story straight. And I, you know, you have to be, obviously you have to be very sensitive to what people feel. And I have a rule to myself that if someone can't go on, I'm not going to push them.
That's the voice of Joe Sacco, and we only have a few minutes left, but I wanted to get your thoughts on modern-day corporate establishment journalism, especially on this topic of Palestine. And you know, as the continued attacks against Palestinian people remain censored, as major networks and news outlets remain unmoved on how they choose or how they're directed to cover up the context and the history of the story in general, what's the responsibility of journalists right now in the context of this story? And you know, what would you say to journalists who are facing censorship or are being ordered to not cover the story in the way that it should be?
Boy, I don't know what to say about to them, really. I mean, clearly a lot of even mainstream journalists have a problem with their editors, I think, often. They, you know, when you sit around and you talk to even mainstream journalists at dinner, you'll get one story, and then when you read their writing, it almost seems antiseptic. It just seems a bit very removed from what's a story they may have described to you in person. I think it's important to get, you know, the stories of Palestinians across so that the reader can really appreciate what's going on, and not be left dangling with this sort of, well, the Israelis say this, the Palestinians say this, and you, the reader, make up your mind. You know, I've sort of finished my responsibility now that I've told both sides. I mean, this is one of the reasons I got involved. I basically felt that the Israeli position is very well represented in the mainstream media, and the Palestinian voices aren't really heard. And it's, you know, I think it's incumbent upon people to, or on journalists to really, to try to give a voice or help give a voice to those people who normally aren't heard. And the corporate media obviously is interested in certain things and certain ways of doing things, and it has its traditions. But, you know, real people are suffering, and I think it's important to get that across. I mean, that's the main reason I started doing this sort of journalism in my own way. And, of course, I hope other journalists, in their own way, whether they're filmmakers, photographers, you know, radio reporters, will find ways to give people a voice, because that's what we're here for.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We turn our attention back to Tegucigalpa, Honduras, where the situation remains dangerous and lethal for those resisting, who continue to resist the coup government there. We have heard in the last weeks of killings, of death squad type killings. There was the killing of the gay rights activist some time ago. Police say they're going to investigate that. Not much has come out. So joining us to give us an update is Andres Canteras. He works with Democracy Now! In Espanol. He's a human rights activist and has been working inside the Brazilian embassy, reporting from there in Honduras, where the president, President Zelaya, is still holding out. Andres, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Dennis, it's a pleasure to be with you and the whole audience listening.
First of all, why don't you just talk a little bit about the situation around the president who went back to be with his people. There was an election in which many people boycotted. Nevertheless, the U.S. confirmed and accepted it as a free and fair election. What can you tell us about the president and that level of resistance?
Well, the president continues to be firm here in the embassy. He has expressed his wish to leave here. However, the coup regime has put conditions that prevent him from doing so. He continues to be very concerned about the repression that continues to escalate here in Honduras under Roberto Micheletti and the de facto government that has been just brutally, brutally treating those who have been participating in the resistance over the past few months. This is the sixth-month point. It was exactly 6 months ago on June 28th that the coup took place, and also this is day 99 of those of us who have been in the embassy accompanying President Zelaya. The repression that has escalated, you mentioned the gay rights activist. That was Walter Troches. He was killed on December the 12th. Since then, on the 14th, on the 16th, on the 17th, more killings of teacher activists, of a 16-year-old who is a journalist, a 16-year-old daughter of a journalist, and the abduction of two members of the peasant movement from the Aguan. That took place on the 17th. And as late as just a few days ago, on December the 22nd, another gay rights activist, Edwin Renan Fajardo, was killed, and they made it appear as if it was a suicide. He was 22 years old. So this intensifying brutality really is what is describing this regime as a death squad democracy. You mentioned the election, Dennis. That election is where the election tribunal said that the participation was over 60%. Well, that's what made the headlines. They later had to correct themselves, and it's now clear that they are saying it was less than 50%. President Zelaya has numbers that it was more around 40% participation. So this really defines that it was a victory for the resistance who called for abstention in the sham of the election.
Now, Andres, the killing of two gay rights activists who have been members of the resistance, as you mentioned, the killing of this teacher's daughter, do these appear to be death squad killings, retaliations? What do we know about them? How can we help understand better what happened here?
Well, they undertake these killings in such a way that they try to make it as hard as possible for evidence to show that it seems to be a pattern. If you look at the incredible way in which these killings take place over time, you begin to see that it's those who have been part of the resistance who are, some of them are put under threat first, others are just killed outright, and you see the numbers continue to grow. There's one other case I'd like to mention, which is someone who's right here in the embassy. We are now down to just 8 people who are accompanying the president and his wife, and one of them is Eddie Gifaro. He worked in the resistance, in the marches, observing. He worked basically in security for the resistance, making sure that those who came in as provocateurs would not do as much damage. Eddie has received direct threat to himself, and now more recently his family is being targeted. He basically, a message has been sent that because he has a long ponytail, that those who are threatening are saying that the ponytail will be a symbol of a trophy, is a way of a death threat against him when he leaves the embassy. He is trying to consider his options in terms of his own safety and also the safety of his family.
Is his family in Honduras now?
Yes, they are in Honduras. A former girlfriend has also received threatening phone calls. They've been threatened in person as well, his family. And so this is an indication that he also will be very much a target when we finally leave this embassy in the next few days or few weeks. We don't know when.
Now, has there been any response by the U.S. government or U.S. officials, the ambassador on the ground there, to these what appear to be death squad attacks?
There has not been any specific mention of the human rights situation in Honduras by the embassy that I've been able to tell. When delegations that support human rights go to the embassy, the embassy says that they have information on the website, but then when we go there's nothing there. In the State Department briefings, the journalists basically raised the question of these human rights atrocities, and the standard line is that U.S. policy is to condemn all kinds of human rights violations, but they have clearly not raised the temperature against the coup regime, even though the repression has escalated.
So Micheletti, the Supreme Court, everybody is still in place.
That's exactly right. And that Supreme Court was put in power earlier this year in January. They have a 7-year term. And this Supreme Court is known to have ratified an illegal coup. And so they will be in power for the next 7 years. And that will be a legacy against democracy for that period of time.
All right. And the status of the president, is President Zelaya negotiating to leave? I know that they want him to apply for exile. They want him essentially to give up his country. Where is that negotiation?
President Zelaya has expressed that he's willing to leave, but he will not do so either under the condition that he resign as president or under the condition that he leave with political exile. And so because the coup regime has insisted on those points, now they're mostly focusing on the political asylum, then he basically has made it clear that he will not leave. There have been efforts by the man who received the most votes in this sham of an election on November 29th, is Porfirio Lobo. He has said that he's in favor of the president leaving the embassy. However, he has really not done anything to make that happen. And there has been no outright pressure from the international community, even though they have continued to express that President Zelaya being incarcerated here is a complete injustice.
Wow. And what do you see, what are your concerns now as you look down the road a little bit? We're hearing about expanding death squad activities, or at least it seems like that. What are your concerns now, and where do you see this going?
Well, the concerns, of course, have to do with the people's desire to have their will expressed in the government, and the way that they are choosing to make that happen is through this constituent assembly that they want to continue to struggle for. As people continue to do that, they will be targeted in an ongoing way, as seen by the pattern that we've talked about here. And so really, both those who work for human rights here in country, as well as international solidarity, need to keep a watchful eye on the ongoing way in which both the current coup regime as well as the forthcoming government under Porfirio Lobo, Pepe Lobo is his nickname, will continue to be involved in repressing the will of the people as they work toward what they want to fulfill.
And so finally, just to understand, if President Zelaya decided at this moment he was just going to get up and go out into the street and live his life as best as he can in the context of what's going on, he would be what? Arrested? He could be shot? What?
He would, in all likelihood, he would be arrested. I believe there are 24 charges against him. And it's very important to raise the point that he is not asking for amnesty. But the amnesty call is being put forward both by the president-elect, Porfirio Lobo, as well as the U.S. government. They are calling for an amnesty in order to whitewash all of the crimes of the coup itself, as well as all the repression that has occurred since then. An amnesty would wipe out all the charges against President Zelaya. However, he prefers to face all of those charges if they can be tried in a free and independent way. In other words, if there were a court that could that would not be a jury and judge against him from the onset, then he would be willing to face all of the charges. The coup regime, on the other hand, does not want to face the charges against it by the international community and human rights organizations. And the U.S. also wants to whitewash the situation. So they are calling for an across-the-board amnesty. President Zelaya, in the accord, did not ask for the amnesty, and so that's why it was not included. But even though that's not part of the accord, they are calling for that.
All right. Andres Canteres reporting from the Brazilian embassy in Honduras, has been there for the last 99 days with the president, Manuel Zelaya. He has worked as a human rights activist for Nonviolence International and with Democracy Now in Espanol. Andres, your work there has been very important. And again, we appreciate the time and urge you to be careful.
Well, sending solidarity to you and Flashpoints, and New Year greetings to all the listeners.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.